You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up the next hour, a judge tells Twitter to give Elon Musk the data about bots that he's been asking for, but also calls Musk's requests absurdly broad. More on that in a moment. Plus, Peloton is going all in on content. After reporting a huge loss, the struggling brand leaning into its digital app, adding new subscription tiers, including a freemium version. We'll talk about the pivot from hardware. And Gen Z isn't about the corporate life. Half of respondents in a new survey say they're trying to make money creating content for social media instead. Will it work? We'll discuss. All that in a moment, but first let's talk a little bit more about Twitter now. That judge in Delaware telling Twitter they got to hand over more information on spam and bots to Elon Musk. Here to talk about that, Bloomberg News, Alex Barinka and Sarah Friar. So, Alex, I'll start with you. Look, the judge asking Twitter to hand Musk the data that he's been asking for. This is data that Musk's camp has said Twitter has been hiding. Not all of it, but some of it. What do we know?
Yeah, it is some of it. Some of a concession in this absurdly broad ask, as the judge called it. Twitter had done a survey of 9,000 accounts, basically looking to see, are there humans connected to these accounts or are they bots? Initially, the company had not turned this over to Elon Musk on a number of concerns, including privacy concerns. But this specific like tranche of data is what the judge is speaking about needs to be turned over to Musk, which frankly does fall squarely in this argument that he's making that he doesn't have enough information yet to say really strongly that Twitter's initial kind of public statements that about 5% of users are bots. Musk says he doesn't have enough data to kind of vet that. So this is one concession here that we do see the judge kind of forcing Twitter's hand to make sure Musk gets a bit more details on what's happening on the platform more broadly.
Well, and Sarah, it seems like most of the orders from the judge so far have gone in Twitter's favor. This one, though, not. I wonder, do you make what you make of this? Is it a clear negative for Twitter?
Well, she's narrowed the broad request to just those 9,000 accounts. And while Twitter has said, you know, we can't give over that data for privacy reasons and other reasons, I think that is limited enough that it's sort of a compromise here for the company. I do think it's a small win for Musk, and it shows that the judge may in some part think that it's true that he doesn't have enough information to gauge whether that 5% number is bots. But let's not forget, I mean, this is not really a debate about bots. This is a debate about whether there's been a materially adverse effect to Twitter in the time since Elon Musk signed that $44 billion contract to buy Twitter. And Twitter would argue, or is arguing, that there has not been a major change, not anything that would get Musk out of that contract. And so if the judge is asking for this data to be handed over, it could go towards answering that question. But I don't know that it will be enough.
All right. We're going to continue to follow that, but I also want to ask about some changes to Instagram today. Instagram, Alex, introducing some new child safety measures. Tell us what these measures involve.
Yeah, so they had some measures in place for teens, think under the age of 16, basically so that they can have a feed that shows them less of content that might be seen as inappropriate for those younger users. Think sexually explicit content, violence, things that are allowed on the app that don't actually violate community guidelines but might not be right for that cohort. The company basically came out and said they will default users under the age of 16 years old to get this kind of less version of the platform that excludes them from seeing some of this content. Now, if you have been watching and following some of Instagram and its sister companies, Facebook's kind of dust-ups in DC regarding child privacy, you'll know that this comes on the heels from a bit of a flurry of activity in DC. There's a couple of actions in the Senate, a bill and an extension on child privacy laws, and an action in the House, basically that have taken a step back to look at these platforms and say, hey, are we really protecting minors who are using the app? Remember, Instagram allows users 13 years old and older on the app, so there are a number of years there where folks are below the age of 18 on social media and might not be the right audience for some more of the explicit content that can show up on that platform.
Interesting. Now, Sarah, of course, you wrote the book on Instagram. Last year, the company announced this big plan to start Instagram for kids. There was a huge public outcry. They put those plans on pause. Do you think that project is done, or could they attempt to, do it again?
I think they're taking a lot of the ideas that they had for Instagram Kids and applying them to teens who are currently on the platform. And let's be clear, I mean, although the rule says 13 and up is allowed on Instagram, there are plenty of 9 and 10 year olds on that app. That's why Instagram has increased the restrictions around, asking you about your birthday. A lot of people recently have been asked that question. That's because Instagram's trying to make sure that they block it to anyone below 13. They're trying to clean up their act and they're trying to improve their reputation. So I think that if they do manage to do that, nothing's off the table. They will always want to expand into new markets, into new demographics. And people who are younger than 13, those are the kinds of users that are really obsessed with YouTube, really obsessed with TikTok, those major competitors of Instagram, that they want to figure out how to make a product for it. And I think social media opens up a lot more concerns than a straight entertainment product might. Because of the connections with strangers and the ability for your own content to be viewed by the masses in a little bit more explicit way. So I think that they're adding this around teens. They added parental controls earlier, ways to have a guardian check up on your account and know who you're connected to, who you're messaging with. All of those are in an effort to try to improve that reputation around child safety so that maybe down the line they could take that extra step and bring the kids' product back.
Meantime, you've got this new survey out that younger people, Gen Z, ditching corporate jobs or not taking them at all because they hope to make a career creating content on social media. Alex, how realistic is this? Obviously, we know that, social media influencers, they can make a lot of money. This is obviously an evolving business that's still likely in its very early stages. Tell us more about this survey and what it tells us.
Yeah, the survey tells us basically that this younger generation, Gen Z, does really want to. Like you said, half of them think about a job outside of the kind of run-of-the-mill job, making money off of social. Now, the caveat here is influencers on social from the platforms themselves aren't making a ton of money. It's about building your following, connecting with sponsors, getting sponsorships, and leveraging that following to make money off the platform. The survey basically broke down some of the numbers and showed that, you know, while there might be a benefit to this flexible work environment, you are your own boss and you need to hustle. Only 12% of these participants surveyed are actually making more than $50,000 a year, which if you live in a place like New York where a lot of these creators are, that's actually below the median income. So folks are hustling. It's also probably why, you know, some of these younger audiences are looking to get on social earlier and build those followings if they have aspirations to turn this into a career. But also, it's not easy. You see the big success stories, but what you don't see are the folks who are on social kind of as a side hustle or kind of really leaning in to turn it to a full-time job because, you know, they are their own boss. Nothing's guaranteed. And it is one of those industries, you know, where you get out of it as much as you put in. You know, we'll see if Gen Z can turn this into the next big economy, but there are certainly a lot of folks with aspirations to make social media their career path.
Well, let's talk about that side hustle part of it, because there's this whole meme right now, quiet quitting, where people are talking about just doing the bare minimum at their jobs, not going above and beyond, trying to maintain a healthy work-life balance. Tara, how realistic is it that some of these folks could, you know, make some extra cash with, you know, that time that they're not spending going above and beyond at their corporate jobs, but making really cool TikToks?
Listen, and I've talked to teens, Gen Z folks who are now in the workforce, who are using Instagram and YouTube alongside their jobs. You know, they have that their personal account, and then they might have a more professional account. Or they might have one that's focused on fashion or food or their pets or home decor, because they want to try something as a you know, creative pursuit, a hobby, that in the back of their minds they're thinking, this could be a fallback plan if my career doesn't work out, or if this becomes, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be paid to travel the world? Wouldn't it be nice to be paid to go to restaurants? Only a select few people end up getting the level of income that you would need to really be micro famous. And then like Alex said, you really got to keep it up. There's a lot of consistency involved. There's a lot of reinventing yourself involved. If you're on Instagram, for example, and you've been posting great photography, now they want you to make short form video. So you have to be really consistent, and you can't quiet quit if you're working for yourself. So I do see it as a side hustle thing, something that kids are doing in college, or I should say adults are doing in college alongside their other work, and hoping that it can help pay the bills if they get the luck of the draw. But I think that that's pretty rare. It's just a general aspiration that people have.
All right, well, we're going to let you go do some other things with your time. Bloomberg, Sarah Fryer, and Alex Borinka, thank you both. We'll be right back. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Peloton shares are reeling from a $1.2 billion loss, but CEO Barry McCarthy says naysayers are looking at it all wrong. Shares jumped 20% this week when Peloton announced its new partnership with Amazon. That gain all but wiped out today. McCarthy, though, is optimistic. He says, what I see is significant progress driving our comeback and Peloton's long-term resilience. For more on that, I want to bring in Rohit Kulkarni, Managing Director at MKM Partners. The worst stock plunge in 7 months. Is it warranted?
Again, thanks for having me, Emily. Not many things to cheer about in today's filing, as in they have consistently underperformed their guidance. They've consistently underperformed our expectations. I think fourth quarter in a row, we are seeing them coming low below our expectations and lowering the guidance. So we don't know yet where the demand is going to essentially stabilize. So I think, to CEO's credit, they are moving fast. They are showing a lot of velocity of execution, but the market is moving against them. The demand curve is slipping very, very quickly, very far away from them.
So how hopeful are you about Barry McCarthy and the possibility of a turnaround?
In terms of what they are doing, whether they can get the results that they hope to get is still probably 6, maybe 12 months out. So there needs to be some patience. While during that time, we hope to have some stability of how in a post-pandemic world, in a post-recession world, in a high inflation world, how people view a high-end product like Peloton and its place in the consumer discretionary spend. So that's the big unknown. But what they can control are a lot of things, and they're lowering prices. They're playing around with some consumer options like renting, fitness as a service. They're going to Amazon and more retailers to try to get a broader audience. So they're doing a lot of things. But as you know, we are in a very, very unusual point in macro cycle. So that is hurting them a lot more than what Barry McCarthy and his team hopes to achieve in a short time.
What do you think of this pivot away from hardware to, you know, offering some freemium classes, for example? How much could that help?
That is helping, but again, as I said, that is opening up their kind of user base to people who are extremely price sensitive. As in, if you were not willing to buy a bike which is worth $2,000 or $1,500 right now, probably you could rent it for a few months for $80, $90, $100. And see how things go. And then of 3 to 4 months, if you feel like using it more, you could buy it, or you could continue to pay $80, $90, $100 per month. So there is a certain cohort of users who may be willing to try that out, and that's still very early days. So there needs to be a full kind of two-directional logistics network they need to set up. They need to have inventory to be able to fulfill such a demand. So it is a good experiment. There is good success so far, but that's exactly it. It's an experiment. It's still very early days. And those experiments, they are doing a lot of those. And I feel encouraged by that. But as I said, like the broader ship, the cargo ship that Barry McCarthy talks about in the letter, it's very slow to turn around. And still, we are not seeing that from the outside, the effort that they are putting in.
All right. Lots to continue to follow. Rohit Kulkarni, MKM Partners Managing Director. Rohit, thanks for stopping by. Amazon is getting greener and leaner. The e-commerce and cloud giant announcing a partnership with the electronic equipment maker.
Plug Power to cut fossil fuel use. Amazon is aiming to hit net zero carbon emissions by 2040. And earlier this week, Amazon announced it'll wind down its telehealth service just weeks after buying One Medical for $3.5 billion. Let's bring in Bloomberg's Spencer Soper, who covers Amazon for us. So what do you make of this latest twist in the Amazon health story? What does it mean in the context of the One Medical acquisition?
Yeah, it does look like there's a lot of overlap between what One Medical provides and what Amazon Care was doing. And One Medical is just, you know, significantly ahead of Amazon Care in terms of its footprint and its customer base and that sort of thing. So, but the only breadcrumbs Amazon really dropped about why it is shuttering Amazon Care is they said that it's not robust enough, that as they try to get this service out, this primary care medical service, that they're trying to target other businesses, you know, to buy it on behalf of their own employees for, that they basically couldn't sell it, you know, that it didn't have a robust enough offering. So it sounds like Amazon's coming back to the drawing board, and whatever it does with One Medical, it's going to have to go above and beyond this this Amazon Care service, which is fairly limited.
Okay, so talk to us about this development in Amazon's push to be green. How significant is it?
I mean, it's a big deal and a big commitment in to the extent of the amount of energy that they'll be purchasing. You know, this 11,000 tons a year beginning in 2025 is basically the entire production of one plant of Plug Power. And Plug Power uses wind and solar energy to create hydrogen, which will then be used as a fuel. So it's a very streamlined green process, trying to have no emissions throughout. And then that amount of fuel will run tens of thousands of forklifts in Amazon's operation, hundreds of trucks. So it's a significant step and a big boost for hydrogen as a clean power source. But it's still, you know, Amazon's carbon emissions have still been going the wrong way, especially after the pandemic. It made this big pledge, but then all the pandemic demand, its carbon emissions still went up significantly by like 40%. So it's got a lot of work left to do yet. Granted, it's got till 2040 to do it.
How optimistic are you that Amazon hits that goal by 2040?
I don't know. I mean, there's so much time between now and then, and who knows, you know, what form e-commerce will be at that time and delivery and that sort of thing. But there's certainly a lot of time left for them to develop alternatives.
Okay. Bloomberg Spencer Soper, update from Seattle. Thank you, Spencer, for joining us.
The iPhone 14 is only a couple of weeks away. Apple's planning to announce the new device on September 7th and put it on sale on September 16th. The new phone will continue to come in four models, two Pro versions and two standard versions, but Apple's replacing the iPhone 13 mini with the new iPhone 14 Max. That will give Apple a standard iPhone with a big 6.7-inch display for the first time. The new Pro phones will have a 48-megapixel camera on the back for the wide-angle lens, thinner bezels around the display, and a faster A16 processor. The biggest design change will be to the front camera. The notch will be replaced with a hole punch size cutout for FaceTime and selfies, and a pill-shaped cutout will come in for Face ID. The Pro models will also have enhanced video recording and better battery life. The new phones are launching about a week earlier than usual, giving Apple an extra chunk of sales for its fourth quarter. Beyond the iPhone 14, Apple's planning to announce an update to the Apple Watch SE with a faster processor, an Apple Watch Series 8 with a body temperature sensor, and its first Apple Watch Pro. That will have a more rugged design and a larger display. Later this year, Apple's aiming to announce revamps to the iPad Pro and the entry-level iPad, in addition to new Macs with M2 Pro and M2 Max based chips. I'm Mark Gurman. This is Power On.
You can subscribe to Mark's weekly Power On newsletter at Bloomberg.com. Let's get back to the markets and take a temperature of the private markets ahead of Fed Chair Jay Powell's big speech this week. Lots of questions about how much further the government will go to tamp down inflation.
How are VCs watching it all? Let's discuss with Andrea Walney, general partner at Manhattan Venture Partners. Andrea, great to have you back with us. So curious what Fed Chair Jay Powell could say that would change things for venture capitalists.
Well, thanks, Emily. So I would say overall, what we're all really eager to see is what the impact on the soaring inflation is going to do for all of us. And generally, I think we're all looking at the outlook of unemployment reaching absolutely five-decade lows. And generally, what does this mean for interest rates when they've really just been hovering at near zero for so long? And I think we are all just taking a pulse on what this employment environment is going to look like going forward. So startups are trying to hire.
Well, exactly. So let's say, you know, the Fed says we're going to take more steps to tamp down inflation. Would you do anything differently? Would you advise your portfolio companies differently?
I think everyone's just trying to reduce spend continuously, Emily, so that they end the year really strong. I know we really just kicked off the second half of the year going into Q3. And so generally, I think every startup in the market right now is still got that hiring freeze going on. And really, they're kind of eyeing the end of the year and saying, well, how do we keep retaining talent? How do we keep ensuring that everyone's incentivized while really, you know, increasing the workload on everyone while hiring is still more or less still at a standstill?
So, you know, are your portfolio companies then thinking about doing more layoffs if this environment continues?
Some of them are. I think generally going into the start of this past year, a lot of the late stage startups at least had big aspirations for big hiring plans. And so generally they are still looking to keep reducing spend across the board. With that said, I think the hiring is still at a standstill. They're not really targeting an increase in budgeting and keeping things really tight. And I think a lot of startups are changing course around their narrative, around their forecast going into the second half of this season.
Is it changing your investment strategy at all? I mean, are you pushing for lower valuations? Are you reducing the amount that you would put into a single company? Do you, as an investor, have more power because, times are tough for some of these companies?
We really are seeing a big shift, and our investment strategy remains the same. So at Manhattan Venture Partners, we are looking at late stage companies that are in the top decile of their sector. They are a category leader. They have strong financial backing. What we're saying is that from a reflective standpoint of the public comparables, right, the publicly traded companies comping to the private startups, we're saying, listen, the valuations of these late stage companies are still really high. Overall, a lot of the companies were still raising at 20 to 40, if not 50 times revenue alongside other fundamentals. And with that said, a lot of them really just don't want to take that valuation cut. So what we're seeing is companies really leveraging debt structures as well as different types of anti-dilution rights that we're kind of putting in place, as well as many other venture capitalists, to say, we don't want to see you raise a down round. We'd rather come up with something really creative as an alternative.
All right. I know you're an investor in Instacart, and Instacart is planning to go public later this year. They've also, you know, done a big, you know, quote unquote, down round, which, you know, they chose to do of their own volition, given the change in the market. Curious what you're expecting for their planned IPO at a time when it seems like the IPO window is pretty much sealed shut.
Yeah, so from what I can share, really, I think generally Instacart is one of many companies who are really still eyeing the market volatility to determine whether to go out this year, if at all, right? Mm-hmm. I know that that's what we're all discussing. Generally, I think that they're a company that really opened up the ambiguity to say maybe they'll go a traditional IPO, maybe they'll do a direct listing, maybe another function of an exit. I think at this point in time, based on what we all know publicly, it seems that a traditional IPO path is probably the safest course of action if they were to go out this season. I think really we all expect that that IPO window is between the third week of September and more or less the absolute latest being the second week of December before the big holiday season. So they have some more time to get ready. I do think that they could be the blockbuster IPO to end the year, but generally I think it's still a little bit shaky and we aren't seeing a course correct in the public market yet to say whether or not for certain they will go out.
There's been a lot of controversy over the very big check that Andreessen Horowitz wrote to Adam Neumann, the co-founder of WeWork, for his new real estate venture. Some don't like it. Some people do. What do you think?
So it is the largest single investment that Andreessen Horowitz has ever written. And I think it's fascinating that they both supported Adam Neumann for Flow, as well as Flow Carbon and everything that he's doing on the blockchain side. I think the strategy here is that obviously Adam Neumann, whether we love him or hate him, is a proven founder, and he could do it again. He already tried it with WeLive, right? And that didn't really pan out. Obviously, there were other things to focus on when he was building WeWork. But overall, I think where it's really fascinating for Andreessen is that they obviously have such a strong focus in cryptocurrency and the future of digital assets. And I think where the narrative really is interesting here is how Adam Neumann says that at Flow, they plan to offer a crypto wallet as part of the entire offering here and say that users could pay to earn and rent to own as well. And so with that being said, I think the overall strategy for Andreessen is that this is not only a category-defining way to change how we all live and where the biggest asset class being real estate could change to democratize that ownership, but it really goes to the thesis that Andreessen has around crypto going forward and how digital infrastructure is going to change. So I think it makes a complete large amount of sense that they coupled this together and said, we've got a proven founder and we're going to take this forward and see that he changes of the world again, and this time in a different asset class.
Interesting take. You know, the controversy aside, what do you make of the size of this check in general? To write a check that big in this very uncertain economic environment?
Yeah, well, Andreessen's funds just keep getting larger, so they do have to start deploying check sizes that are quite sizable across the board. So I do expect to see more of that from them as a fund. But with Flow specifically, I would say that this is a company that's going to need a lot of capital to keep acquiring the units that they have. I mean, as of right now, they have 3,000 apartment units under their mandate. And going forward, it's going to require an increasingly large amount of capital and doing it at a velocity that's really high. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me. But I would say with this capital, I would expect that they're probably well off for the next 2 years when it comes to their runway.
All right. Andrea Wolny, general partner at Manhattan Venture Partners. Good to have you back with us. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Coming up, the Ethereum merge is fast approaching. We're going to talk about what it all means for the rest of the ecosystem with Ava Labs president John Wu. Next, this is Bloomberg.
We've seen a number of other proof-of-stake networks already be successfully launched. Solana, Near, Avalanche. I mean, essentially, Bitcoin and Ether are the only proof-of-work networks still alive. And we haven't seen any issue on the other proof-of-stake networks. And I think proof-of-stake will be just fine.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Time now for our crypto report, and as Bitcoin may be poised for another downward move, let's talk about what that means in the general ecosystem with our next guest, John Wu, president of Ava Labs, the lead developer of the Avalanche blockchain, and of course our crypto contributor, Shanali Basak. John, we're all bracing for whatever Jay Powell has to say coming up on Friday. Curious what you're watching for and how whatever he says could mean for the crypto ecosystem.
Well, Bitcoin and Ethereum now are at 0.75 in terms of correlation with the NASDAQ. So what the market is saying is it's all high risk assets are correlated. And Jay is going to raise rates. You know, I think Shanali cited yesterday Dan Moorhead from Pantera, I knew him from Tiger, saying that we need rates to go a lot higher. And I agree, it will go a lot higher. But what I think the market needs to understand is that there will be alpha in the crypto asset space. And there's very good reasons for that. The fundamentals are absolutely increasing and improving. The technicals, I mean, there's, if you think about the crypto market caps, they've gone down, but stable coins have not. And that tells you a lot of people are just hiding and they're ready to deploy. And finally, I know you guys ultimately want to talk about the merge with Ethereum, and that's a huge catalyst. So I think what's going to surprise people is that 0.75 correlation, no matter where the market goes, will go down and you're going to have some alpha in the space.
John, some major investors in the crypto space, you said you worked at Tiger. Dan Moorhead also worked at Tiger before. Mike Novogratz previously at Fortress. How much do you need to be in touch with the macro to get the fundamentals right in crypto? Is it more about the protocols or is it more about what's happening around the ecosystem?
Well, I've had the benefit now of being of an operator for 5 years and being an investor in technology for longer than that. So I think having a macro perspective is always very important. You know, when you wake up in the morning, you need to know what season it is so you know what clothes you put on. But then what clothes you put on is dictated by your personal tastes and exactly how warm it is. So as an operator now, I'm really focused on getting more users in, getting the masses into the space, getting more developers. There's a few hundred thousand developers in the space. There's 30 million plus web developers. All these layer ones should be working on getting more of those developers and more applications and more use cases into the space. And by the way, those use cases, they are really happening. So there's a lot of operating momentum.
Speaking of developers, you're seeing people in the industry get paid to help kind of fix up any issues that might be pertaining to the Ethereum merge that is so highly anticipated. So a lot of people hard at work. How might the merge affect other assets outside of Ethereum?
This is great because I know it makes great headlines to say Ethereum killer and market share here. Again, I'm in the belief that the space is so small that the space should work together to help the masses come over and bridge that gap. I'm rooting as an operator for Ethereum merge to be smooth and to happen on September 15th very well. I mean, Avalanche is EVM compatible. Assets move back and forth. There's a bridge where over $50 billion of assets have moved back and forth between Ethereum and Avalanche. So the more people that come into the ecosystem, the more applications get developed, it's good for many layer ones, in my opinion. I think what your users... should also be hopeful that the merge goes well. I mean, you know, your viewers love to invest in companies like Coinbase, one of the best companies out there and that's a listed company. And if the merge goes well, basically that's going to allow the concept of staking happen and individuals, institutions can earn 8-9%. Now, the way Coinbase works is that's a whole new revenue stream. If using their current, you know, formula of take rates and stuff, that potentially could mean $600 million of revenue for Coinbase. And that's off of a base of this year, probably around $3.8 billion. So that's significant and it's very good for Coinbase stock. So I think your viewers should be rooting for a successful merge as well.
you know, it's clearly been a volatile year, and it could continue to be volatile through the rest of the year. What is your outlook on how long this quote-unquote winter lasts, and, you know, where we are at this time, let's say, next year?
It is. So I personally think the winter will be here for a little bit longer, but what I'm really looking forward to is these new applications, these new protocols that literally redefine the way businesses operate and businesses will be built. I mean, what you can do when tokenization is here in full swing is you're going to encode the business logic into a smart contract, and then the platform is the business. So that, what does that mean? That means, like, right now we're talking about Coinbase. I mean, Coinbase has about 5,000 employees, market cap of $16 billion. It has about $2.4, $2.5 billion of daily volume. A company like Uniswap, also an exchange in the DeFi ecosystem, it has $1 billion of volume a day, and that's about 100 employees mm-hmm. only there. So if you do the token cap and the market cap to employees, at Coinbase, it's about $3 million of value created by employee, roughly. At Uniswap, we're talking about like $48, $50 million worth of value created by each individual. So what we're doing is we're going to redefine what businesses are. And the best part of this is the network effects that happen will accrue back to the users,
I need to really get your opinion here on something, because you were talking about staking. And, you know, really quickly here, what is staking most like in traditional financial services? The reason I ask is because if it's going to be a bigger part of the ecosystem, Coinbase might start making it a bigger part of its product suite. Is it subject to regulation in a way that a traditional lending product would be or a clearinghouse would face?
Well, philosophically, what it is, it doesn't exist in the traditional world. You know, the way value is distributed in the traditional world is really, and created and distributed is really two ways, right? There's labor, and then there is using your capital to make more money. With labor, you get paid for the value add you create. Capital, you take your existing money, you put it to work, and hopefully you get a return on it. Staking is a combination of the two. You are actually taking your existing capital, helping validate and secure a blockchain, and therefore getting a reward as well as a yield for it. So it's a hybrid. And when you talk about how do you regulate that, that's a really good question, because is it labor or is it actually dividends and yields? It's not clear. I kind of think you're putting things to work, and that's the spirit of permissionless, being part of the community, helping make decisions, and getting rewarded for your efforts, not necessarily just putting your collateral down and getting a yield.
All right. Lots to think about. John Wu of Ovlabs, good to have you back as always, and our own Shanali Basik. Thank you. Something else we're following, Sony raising the price of its PlayStation 5 console in major markets outside the U.S. by as much as 20%. The move is in response to global inflation rates and currency trends impacting consumers and creating pressure on multiple industries. I sat down with Microsoft Gaming CEO Phil Spencer to talk about its relationship with other platforms like Sony. I first asked him why he's such a big proponent of cross-platform gaming. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Maybe you happen in your household to buy an Xbox and I buy a PlayStation and our kids want to play together and they can't because we bought the wrong piece of plastic to plug into our television. It just seems that these artificial constraints that the industry might put up for near-term kind of business dynamics, in the long run, if you take a business that is at 3 billion people growing to 4 billion people over the next decade and saying, how do we continue to grow this business, reducing friction for our customers as an industry has to be at the top.
So how far does this go? Does this mean that Activision games, that Call of Duty, you'll be able to play on any platform in perpetuity?
I don't know what that means in forever, like when you think about how long, and it's not for any kind of nefarious business reason, it's just like, what do even platforms mean 10 years ago. Like, I think the definition of some of these things might change over time, but our expectation is we want more people to play.
So I know you're working with Sony
on some things for the benefit of gamers. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
We have a pretty big publishing footprint on PlayStation as well as Nintendo, which means we have good relationships with those platforms because they're a big part of our business and we're a big part of their business. I think our long-term ambition of where we see this industry growing is also shared. I think the area where things get stuck a little bit, it's in the kind of near midterm competition. If somebody walks into a store and they have one $500 bill, they're either gonna walk out with a Switch, which is what most people buy, or they're gonna walk out with a PlayStation 5, or they're gonna walk out with an Xbox, or maybe somebody will go buy a Windows PC. But in that world of somebody's gotta make a decision for one platform over another in the beginning, that is where I think we get stuck in some of the kind of near-term competition. I don't think that's bad, mm-hmm. right? It's just the dynamic of each of us pushing each other to build the best product for our customers.
You can watch the full edition of Bloomberg Studio 1.0 with Microsoft Gaming CEO Phil Spencer at Bloomberg.com or check out the podcast. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Coming up Friday, Affirm CEO Max Levchin joins me to talk about the company's revenue forecast for 2023, its earnings just out, shares under pressure, as well as the future of buy now, pay later. And don't forget to check out our Bloomberg Tech Podcast, anywhere you can get your podcast, for your daily tech roundup. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it. If you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.